Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
Probably the easiest thing I've ever done. The medication comes in the mail and it's very easy to use. I've been able to live my normal lifestyle and I've lost 20 pounds already and I've never felt better. It changed my life.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Behind the Knife. This is Karan Chabra, and I'm excited to introduce another episode of our How I Built It series with the Association for Academic Surgery, Clinical and Health Services Research Committee. Today, we'll be interviewing Dr. John Birkmeyer, who's one of the founding leaders of health services research and surgery, and really helped us understand variation in surgical quality and outcomes. Dr. Birkmeyer will take us through the history of surgical outcomes research and his own journey from Dartmouth to the University of Michigan, back to Dartmouth, and then to his current role at Sound Physicians. And he'll talk about his thoughts on the future of health services research and what we can contribute as surgeons and scientists. So Dr. Birkmeyer, thank you for joining us today for the AAS How I Built It series.
Thank you, Karan.
So to start, for our listeners, can you tell us how you got started in health services research, especially at a time when so few people and almost no surgeons were involved in this field?
Well, I tell you, I got into the field by serendipity, some would say failure. I wound up at Dartmouth as a preliminary general surgery intern outside of the match. I finished my couple of clinical years there. I had a categorical slot available to me, but it required that I take a couple of years off to spend in the quote-unquote lab. At that time, Dartmouth had very limited opportunities for surgical labs, but I did happen to be at the epicenter of health services research, Jack Weinberg, and the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare. And via a combination of mentors and availability of data for that type of research, just by accident, I was at the right place.
No kidding. So it was really just an accident.
It was really just an accident. As I look in retrospect, I had some of the right attributes that ultimately would help me later on as a health services researcher. I was a mathematics major as an undergrad, and thus was comfortable working with big data sets and in analytics. I also had a political bent, which drew me into the health policy side of the field.
And did you do a research fellowship in the same way that residents today do in the middle of your residency?
It was similar in some ways, but different in others. So I applied for it and was lucky to receive a research fellowship funded by the National Library of Medicine. And while technically my fellowship was in medical informatics, I chose to allocate most of my time and coursework into health policy and working with big data sets. It was different to the extent that given just a paucity of academic surgery mentors at that time, I worked most closely with either non-clinicians or with general internists.
And tell us what that was like. I'm trying to picture the world of health services research at that time, and I imagine there was not much at all. So, in the sort of conventional world of academic surgery, did you experience any pushback or skepticism? And if so, how did you handle it?
I think it's fair to say that health services research wasn't a thing at that time. When I would attend the Association for Academic Surgery or the SUS meetings at the time, there was little or no meeting time allocated to, what was then just called outcomes research. I would occasionally get pulled into a panel to talk about the future of health service, to talk about the future of academic surgery, but I was always the, kind of the only voice or the token member of that nascent field.
And when it came to, trying to present your work in important forums, trying to change practice, and trying to maybe advance professionally, how did you convey the value of your work?
Well, at that time, my focus was spread out across several surgical specialties, was focused as much in clinical outcomes and clinical epidemiology as it was in some of the more controversial, areas of research that I would gravitate to later. I can tell you, though, that, there was then a pretty strong skepticism about health services research as serious science. I can remember vividly in my very first year on the faculty at Dartmouth, the very first grant that I ever wrote was first to the American College of Surgeons and then to the American Surgical Association. They were both $25,000 grants, and they were both the science underlying what would later become my volume outcome papers. Both of those grants were not funded. Fortunately, the NIH felt differently a couple of years later, but I remember the one paragraph critiques associated with both of those grants well, and both of them, just to paraphrase, said, this isn't science, this is just data mining.
And so what can folks today take away from that? It sounds like you, in addition to the controversial work on the volumes and outcomes relationship, you mentioned that you might have had some more sort of conventional or low-risk work. Is that something that you'd recommend to folks trying to get started today?
Well, I can't claim any credit to being prospective in my thinking or strategic. I was really doing what I gravitated towards or the types of research that my various mentors were funneling towards me. Mm-hmm. What I can say is that, what I appreciated then and the advice I still give to trainees now is to focus first on acquiring, the basic skills and in the toolbox for success in health services research, however your clinical career evolves over time. And that was certainly my own personal experience, doing various types of research applied to a variety of different surgical disciplines. And it was only when I got on to the faculty that I began to focus on, using large Medicare claims data sets to understand variation in both the use of surgery, but more particularly variation in outcomes in the role of volume.
Now, I know you really got started on this work at Dartmouth, and then once you were recruited to Michigan, can you tell us about how you went about building the infrastructure here and how in turn, you allowed so many other researchers, including myself, to learn and flourish?
So I came to Michigan via some combination of push and pull factors. The push had nothing to do with, my affection for Dartmouth, but I was just a little bit stale in what I was doing. I had agreed to be the chief of the section of general surgery, and a couple years into that role, I realized that was, that I was just not passionate about how I was spending my time. I came to Michigan because Mike Mulholland, then the chair at the University of Michigan, was very persuasive. And among the selling points he made to me was, was the prospect of working kind of with a much deeper pool of committed surgeon scientists and being able to partner with and ultimately leverage sort of, larger reservoir of surgeon scientists. And in the end, that's not only why I came to Michigan, but ultimately why we were successful in building the health services research shop at University of Michigan. As I think about sort of, both my strategy, but also, some of the factors behind our success, I'll acknowledge up front that it was more organic success than it was forward-looking strategy. But I can tell you kind of as I thought about it then and as I think about it now, I think the most important choices that we made, either implicitly or explicitly, was one, focusing first and foremost on building a intellectual critical mass and recruiting a pipeline of young surgical faculty either at or on the brink of scientific and financial independence. So when I came to Michigan, you know, kind of the large part of my role as the, you know, founder of the Surgery Health Services Research Shop there was in recruitment and selling talented partners to join me. And I, you know, had a lot of early successes in that regard, you know, and to, name just a couple people from a much longer list, getting folks like Arden Morris and Sandra Wong and Justin Dimmick and Dave Miller and Brent Hollenbach to sign on early in their own careers, ultimately, you know, was very instrumental in, you know, the success that the center were to enjoy later. I focused, you know, there's many ways that an academic leader of a surgical health services research shop can choose to focus his or her time in terms of his or own work and how much time gets devoted to mentorship and at what level. You know, kind of my own focus at that time was to make sure that my own work was moving forward. You know, the old saying when you get on the airplane is, you know, be sure to secure your own oxygen mask before before assisting others, and making sure that I myself was independently funded was pretty essential, both, you know, for the financial model, but also for my own credibility. In terms of mentorship, you know, kind of my own focus was very disproportionately on the junior faculty, you know, and, you know, first and foremost, ensuring that we recruited the right people, that we as quickly as possible got them established on career tracks and funded via K award mechanisms as quickly and as often as possible, and then from there moving them to financial independence via R01 or equivalent funding. I did not focus at the outset on how to build the bench with talented medical students or even with surgical residents or fellows, but once the pipeline had been built and there was a larger array of mentors, there was a big multiplier effect in making sure that we had good diversity at every level of skill and training. And then I think the third, you know, part of the strategy in building a successful program was less on the tactics and more on building the right type of culture. You know, focus on and focused on sort of a model of very open sharing of data and of scientific work products, including grants, and getting everybody to, you know, to borrow from each other and to stand on each other's shoulders, and establishing that culture of not only fun but also trust. And then finally, you know, kind of our success was driven as much by what we didn't do as much as what we did do. And by that, I mean that we let sort of the scientific and intellectual focus of the group grow organically and not try to pre-program it. So, you know, so for example, while as part of my own recruitment to the University of Michigan, I got, you know, a very generous research package to fund a scientific infrastructure, we did not follow kind of what I've called the field of dreams model, where we hire a whole bunch of support staff and non-faculty, personnel and infrastructure. We focused all of those resources on developing the faculty, and then secondarily, you know, hired the people, bought the data, you know, in the types of supporting infrastructure to ensure that they, move forward quickly.
So it sounds to me like a big piece of this is recruiting, and you mentioned some really big names in health services research now who you helped recruit and mentor, and Dr. Wong, Dr. Morris, Dr. Dimmick. What did you look for at that time in a mentee? How did you know that they would be successful?
I think that, you know, most important factors are interest, intellectual talent, and third in order of priority was previous expertise in health services research training. At the time that we were starting, there simply was a pretty negligible pipeline of trained, academic surgical faculty that had gone through either an RWJ program or a comparable health services research training program. So we really had no choice but to take people that had the right, had the right aspirations in the talent and had some prospects of building up that skill. Now that things have evolved and we're 10 or 15 years later, I think it's, almost expected that, that recruiting, new faculty would imply some expectation of previous training in the data sciences or more formally in health services research methodology.
How did your, you have a long history of research in surgical quality and outcomes and costs, and you transitioned from that to system leadership roles and broader impacts in the private sector. How did what you learned doing research on quality and outcomes and costs inform what you wound up doing in health system leadership?
So, I'm one of those people that is not guilty or at least incapable of long-term planning. I've always thought about my own career in 5 or at most 10-year chunks. And, my decision ultimately to leave the University of Michigan to executive leadership roles was driven, largely by, a desire for different challenges, but also a desire to apply what I had learned as a scholar into, on the ground making healthcare better. And I think that there's different pathways towards executive leadership, whether it's in the academic sector or it's in the private sector world, but there's certain things that good health services researchers do that give them a big advantage in many of those executive leadership roles. For example, a large, a significant expectation of leadership roles is the ability to affect change and affect change through changes in physician behavior. And some of the skills that we acquire as academics in communication and in persuasiveness, whether it's in written or verbal form, is really instrumental to the success of a leader. Good health services researchers are really comfortable in data, and not just statistical analysis, but being able to interpret secondary data and to make reasonable inferences and apply those inferences into organizational strategy. I've certainly found in my role back at Dartmouth Hitchcock in managing its health system and its accountable care organizations that was a valuable skill to have. I've certainly found since joining the private sector that those same skills are just as valuable, if not more so. And then finally, my own area research over the 20 years that I was in academia, largely focused on the themes of variation in hospital quality and costs, variations in surgeon performance, and the types of strategies for reducing variation and improving quality, and certainly those skills as an academician had direct applicability to what I'm charged with now as a health system leader.
I might put you on the spot and ask if you can give an example of a leadership problem you were tasked with, or a quality problem that you were tasked with, and how you applied what you knew from your academic career to that challenge.
Sure. Of many examples I could pull from is my current experience with Sound Physicians. As you know, I'm the chief clinical officer for Sound, and in that capacity, I'm responsible not just for clinical operations, but also for our success in value-based payment models. Whether they're population health payment models or episode payment models like BPCI. In that capacity, success implies, understanding kind of the core sources of variation in episode spending around hospital stays, and a lot of the research that I did both through my NIH-funded work at Michigan, but also in my applied work with the Michigan Value Collaborative, implied sort of understanding kind of what are the biggest sources of variation in healthcare spending, which subset of those are most actionable, and what are the types of physician behaviors or supporting care models that can affect change.
So that's interesting, and I can certainly see now how looking at care variation, looking at spending variation, would directly inform your role now, having to manage it directly. So going forward, what do you think are the biggest challenges for health services research to tackle in the next 10 years?
So let's focus just on academic surgery, and there is now and always will be pressures to understand sort of the root drivers of variation in surgeon performance, and and how to not only reduce variation but to make surgeons better. There's some really fascinating work that's being done here at the University of Michigan about that leverages video analysis, surgeon coaching, and other scalable improvement platforms that can be applied across very broad groups of surgeons that I think are really impactful and are likely to be fascinating when they're ultimately published. But as I think about the future, there's really important areas that have been relatively neglected relative to surgical quality. The first is better understanding and identifying practical levers for reducing healthcare spending associated with surgery. As healthcare spending associated with surgical care approximates $700 or $800 billion a year. The scientific work to date, both mine and others, has focused largely on variation and how to improve spending around episodes of surgery. But arguably, the larger source of variation is associated with decisions about whether to operate in the first place. So so science that addresses practical models for getting at appropriateness for quality of surgical decision making and finding the right combinations of technology, financial incentives, and accountability for driving that change, I think is a ripe area for focus, not just for health system executives, but also for the scholars that are supporting that work. The other really promising avenue for future surgical health services researchers is in the domain of new technology and artificial intelligence. Outside of surgical care, the deployment of big data algorithms and machine learning for driving, more consistent clinical decisions, and for making much more efficient routine health decisions is moving incredibly quickly, and a lot of that innovation is being driven in the private sector. I see no reason why the same types of technology won't also be applied to high stakes decisions about the value of a potential surgical procedure. AI approaches to what used to be called shared decision making just have tremendous value in not only mitigating some of the perverse financial incentives that then go both directions that currently skew surgical decision making and drive unwanted variation in practice, but also have the ability to leverage big data and to truly understand the potential value and clinical effectiveness of specific operations applied to specific patients.
Excellent. So here we have now for the next 10 years our research agenda in academic surgery. To wrap up, I just wanted to ask, what is something that most of our listeners wouldn't know about you? Can you give us some fun facts or some fun trivia that we can go home with?
Well, I've shared a lot of my dirty laundry in previous forums, and I won't reiterate here, but one fun fact that's not widely recognized is that in college, I was the editor of the Observer of Boston College, the school's conservative newspaper. Knowing what I know now about sort of the state of American politics and the occupant of the White House, I'm a little bit embarrassed about sort of that that personal history. But as I reflect back on sort of the launching of that newspaper in the time, it's very similar to how I felt during the early days of the surgical health services research movement in insurgency, Molotov cocktail throwing, and one that ultimately matured over time.
It sounds like some things have changed, but some things never will.
Exactly right, Karin.
Well, thank you, Dr. Brookmeyer. This is a great interview, and I'm looking forward to sharing it with our listeners.
Thank you for having me.
Until next time, dominate the day.